This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, which is an organization and community devoted to these very themes.
During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content.
Before we get started with today's episode, we wanted to make a quick announcement. You can now visit the official Memento Morbid online store. Here you can support the show with t-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, coffee mugs, and more, all of which feature the beautiful logo designed by our good friend, Lauren Seeley. If you'd like to take a look, you'll find everything at mementomorbidmerch.dashery.com. Every purchase helps support the podcast and allows us to keep bringing these conversations to you. My guest today is a professor and scholar of religion and Black studies, best known for her work on African-American conjure, hoodoo, and Africana religions. Most recently, she acted as a consultant for Ryan Coogler's acclaimed film Sinners, ensuring that the portrayals of hoodoo, rootwork, conjure, Christianity, and related Black religious practices in 1930s Mississippi were historically and theologically accurate.
He said, "It's got vampires." I was like, I don't do horror. I said that. And then he said, "Oh, Professor, you're going to like this story." And I was like, okay, say more. And so he told me the story before he had filmed it. And when he got to the scene and he got so excited trying to describe that center point scene, but he was so excited. I was like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about.
Which scene do you mean? Do you mean the dance scene?
The center scene where the dancing occurs. He hadn't filmed it. He's sort of mocking it up and he's excited. And then I saw it and it hit me. I was like, oh, are you saying the ancestors come into the present day? I was like, it's effacing time. It's the present. It's the past because they're already dead. And it's the future as well.
Before we bring today's guest in, let's enjoy a listener's story, question, or encounter revolving around death.
This is Michael in the UK, listener since episode one, although I don't really think of myself as a death person as such, but something happened to me recently I thought I might share with you. I'm lucky enough to live near a rather glorious beach, and I went down to the beach a couple of weeks ago just as the British summer was gathering pace. And as I was walking down the causeway, I saw a strange group of people walking ahead of me, a real mix of dress. Some people were in their beach gear, some were in much more formal clothing. And one of them was carrying a big carrier bag, big shopping bag. I kind of tagged along behind them. And as they got about halfway down the beach, they all gathered around a rock pool. It seemed strange because there was nothing particularly notable about where they were standing. A few people said a word, and then shopping bag was opened, and I realized what was going on. It was the scattering of the ashes, I think, of the uncle of one of the group. And it didn't last more than 5 minutes, and they all dispersed, had a friendly chat as they went back up the beach. And I thought, what a glorious way this is to go. Just a really nice family moment, presumably at a location that their loved one had always loved visiting. And I thought, maybe, just maybe, that's how I'd like to finish my time here on Earth.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter with death that you would care to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. Just add the number in the episode description to your contacts. Our guest today is historian, author, and scholar Yvonne Chereau, who has devoted her career to African-American conjure, hoodoo, folk healing, religion, and supernatural belief in the United States. She is the author of the wonderful book Black Magic, Religion in the African American Conjuring Tradition, and serves as the Peggy Chan Professor of Black Studies and Professor of Religion at Swarthmore College, where her teaching has focused on Africana religions, African American religious history, and Black women's spirituality. This year, Yvonne also served as the hoodoo consultant and historical advisor for Ryan Coogler's acclaimed film Sinners, working with the creative team to ensure the accuracy of the film's depiction of the spiritual traditions and ritual practices within. Yvonne, welcome to Memento Morbid. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I'm so excited. You know, you and I have had many talks in private about the things that I want to talk about today, just to share it with a wider audience. Much of your professional life has been devoted to African American religious traditions, especially conjure and hoodoo. And I wonder if you could explain what those things are and what drew you to it.
You're right. And when you think about it, I have been looking at this for a long time, even before I started academic studies. So a lot of times these things are personal interests, right? And then some of us are just really fortunate to be able to bring this into our professional curiosities. So my question was, in thinking about this thing called magic, and magic is something that it's a category. And in the study of religion, and I'm a religionist, it doesn't seem to have a place. It doesn't seem to have a home. It's something that's studied by anthropologists. Historians look at the idea of magic as an idea that is historically located in certain times. But religionists, it seemed like they were, we don't want to talk about this thing. So, of course, I want to know more about this. So I think the genesis of my work in looking at Black American religions, which are fascinating in and of themselves, was trying to place this notion of magic, both within religious studies and then within my subject. I can say this personally and professionally, I adore African American religions. And when people hear me say that, they immediately think of the beautiful and vibrant traditions of the Black church, which at one point I was a part of, but that's just a small piece of it. So we're looking at not just the Black churches, we're looking at African-based religious traditions, things like Santeria, Regla de Ocho, traditions of African origin. We're looking at Islam in the United States with its mystical elements. We're even looking at Black atheism, because we know that Black religious folk do everything differently from white religious folk. Some places they overlap. So if you believe that Black American religion is immensely diverse, what happens to the category of magic? And so my studies took me to something that I began to look at in the context of American slavery, a tradition. I get in trouble when I call it magic, and we'll talk about why. I like to think of it as more of a culture than a religion or a magic or magics called hoodoo. And we begin to see glimpses of this tradition very early on when Africans were being brought to the colonies, what later became the United States. And I was fortunate, and I was in grad school, not too many people had written on it. So I jumped onto this because it was a way to answer a lot of questions, particularly that question of magic, which to me is not a scary word at all. And I think for your listeners, it's an exciting word. What we do know that magic as a category, particularly in the religious context, becomes the religion of the other. It becomes othered in ways that are very interesting, and then ways I think that are difficult, more difficult.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And when I'm hearing you talk about magic, I'm also thinking about, I know you've done a lot of work with a guest that we interviewed a few months ago, Jeff Kripal, who I feel like has done so much to open up the ability to talk about things like magic and religious studies, you know, made it safe in academia to confront some of these subjects, right?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Jeff has done, he's done so much in a different direction. And we're dear friends now because he had a very clear project. He actually wants to save the idea, not so much magic, but notions of supernaturalism and paranormalism, the categories that, again, you know, in religion, you're like, you're not supposed to talk about. My project's a little different because I don't know if I want to save it. I can be convinced if enough people ask me, but I don't know if it should be saved or whether it should be revalued. Okay. And that's what Black Magic is trying to do.
Right. Could you talk a little bit about the title of Black Magic to that? Because I think it's such a, even just by titling the book that, you're playing with these preconceptions, I think,
yeah,
about like African-American magic and this idea of deviant or dark magic. And how do those things intertwine? I see a lot of fear there. What are you playing with in that title? And what misconceptions do you think might be behind that?
Yeah, it was definitely provocative. And I didn't realize that because, so a little background here is that the study of African American religion is actually fairly new. It came about in the 70s. And the 70s were a time when in the academy, actually something called Black Studies was beginning to get off the ground.
Right.
And there was a lot of conversation. What do we call this thing? Is it Black? Is it African? Whatever. And so Black religion came out of that. And two of my mentors were part of that initial movement. So for me to talk about Black religion is natural. It's not like that now. Now we talk about, oh, Africana. We talk, okay. So I said, oh, I'm looking at magic and I'm looking at Black religion, put them together. But you're absolutely right. It was sort of a play on words. And the title, frankly, it was my dissertation, but when the book came out, a lot of people got very nervous. And of course, I was like, what? This is wonderful. Mm. And I think that still comes down to us today. I get comments all the time. Okay, is it Black magic the scary thing? Or is there such a thing as Black magic the scary thing? Or are you just talking about Black people and that crazy stuff that they do? So very provocative. But I think that's good because then people open the book and they start to follow the story. But it was intentional, but more or less, I'm trying to pay homage to the academic study of, I'm going to call it Black religion because I know this wasn't there before,
yeah,
but the academic study of Black religion and then put this other category underneath it.
That makes a lot of sense. And you were just speaking too about your childhood and being interested in magic. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about that and what brought you to this place.
This is something I love. And you know, Jeffrey Kripal's really good at this too, getting people to remember, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. When I had that experience and I saw the UFO, the Martian, when I was younger, I can talk about it because it's not, and he's really good about that. In African-American discourses, it's a little bit of a different direction because these experiences, whether you call them supernatural or paranormal, are often embedded in the religious context. So I grew up in a family. My father is from the French Antilles. He's a scientist, so he's kind of secular, but they had their traditions. I went to Catholic school for a while. But I remember very early on, as many of us do, if we sit down and think about it, seeing the little fairy lights, being out in the garden and seeing, you know, the little, they call them elves. I didn't have a word for them. The imaginary friends of our youth. And it just really struck me. I really loved going to church, except the Sunday school part, you know. But I love the sense of the sacred. I felt like those things were disconnected. And yet, because I had a spiritual sensibility, I was like, no, when I sit in the church, I also see, because we're not seeing with our eyes, the beauty of the thing. I was a kid and I was really into fantasy, as a lot of us are. As we grow, those things fade. We question them. We say they aren't real. And then at some point, if we're lucky, we come back and we revisit them. We're like, oh my goodness. It was real all the time. So, but that was part of my coming into religion. I don't know if this is your experience too, Joanna. I didn't know you could study this stuff. I thought that, you know, you go to school and you learn math or whatever, but that you could dedicate yourself in a way of studying it. And for me, that when I realized that, it was really late. It was in college, actually. I was off and running because to me, there was nothing more important or more beautiful, right? And sort of revisiting those senses, those sights that you had that I had when I was a child. I think a lot of us have those stories. Jeffrey Kripal talks about this. Sometimes these are marked with terror. Sometimes they're utterly sacred. sometimes they're just in the middle. Oh, I saw like an orb, you know, that sort of thing. But as a kid, that was really appealing.
And was your family pretty receptive to the things that you saw? I think that makes such a difference, whether it's terrifying or sacred too, is if there's a tradition in which people can understand it, you know, that's my conjecture.
That absolutely right. That could make the difference utterly. Yeah, my family was really, they just wanted my sister and I and my older brother who wasn't there, wanted us to learn. So my mother, though, she was so encouraging. She, after, you know, I would tell her, or she would see me, she would watch my eyes, and seeing something on the ceiling. And she's like, oh, this child is touched. This child is touched, you know. So there are traditions in the Black community that are signs that a young person or even a baby being born there, that is, she didn't think about it that way, but she's like, oh, so she would say, well, why don't you go to the spiritualist churches? Why don't you go to the Holy Ghost? But again, the only frame of reference for this was the church. It wasn't like, oh, go study or go, you know. So that was good. So they absolutely, my mother absolutely encouraged it, anything to keep me out of trouble. Because I was a wild, you don't know it now, but I was a wild child. I really was. So.
Well, I love that story, because the fact that your mother even saw different options to encourage your visions and your experiences in the church is pretty remarkable, probably to most listeners. What I'm hearing when you talk about this is how not marginalized this is, you know, this experience where I feel like in the Christian world, and I know it's hard to generalize because there are so many forms of devotion and theologies, but so often, and I feel like that's what we started talking about at the very beginning, right? Magic is not discussed. We don't discuss that part. It's pushed away. And how amazing that your mother is like, oh, we could take you here. I find very interesting and moving.
As I'm talking about it, it's coming back to me. And my mother's been gone maybe 15 years. I think she thought, and I thought too, that I was going to be an artist. So not only did she have me going around, she put me in every kind of art club, art school. I resisted all of it, but I was always either drawing or painting. And I think she thought that that was not going to be a career path, but that was a way of opening up the inner life of the child. I didn't really realize that until I thought about it. Because when you think about it, art is, and you would know more about this, art is sort of the channel. It's sort of the creative channel for a lot of our spiritual, impulses or sensibilities, whatever. And to have someone in your family, I mean, most people, I guess back then, art, can't make any money doing that. But she's encouraging her daughter. This is what's interesting too. My sister, who's older, more brilliant, and more famous than me, went the route of my father, which was sort of the science. My father was an engineer and a scientist, and she went that way. Not that any of us saw that there was a contradiction, but it was a different sort of feeling. So that's really cool. The idea that my mother saw the artist in me as a way that I could actualize myself, which is really rare. Although I don't know, maybe it's not. I don't know your story and how you made your way to art, but it's really just a beautiful thing that she did for me.
Yeah, I think how you're talking about it is so interesting, because I've been thinking increasingly lately that art is like one of the only condoned paths to the sacred in our culture, at least in non-religious families. It's the only place where people are constantly thinking about mystery and thinking about connecting to something bigger than themselves and getting outside the ego head. Many of the things that for a lot of people are part of the religious domain. And I was really struck by this when I was in India and I was at all these temples with all this incredible art. I suddenly realized, like, we only call it art because we're not sacred anymore. It wouldn't even be called art. That's not what it is in India. These are devotional objects made in devotion, intended as containers for the divine, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Art is actually one of those categories. It's like magic. So even if you think of Black American religious art, I don't even know if there's such a thing. I picked up on that early on. I'm like, no, folks aren't painting. They can't even afford it. They're making what the anthropologists like to call material cultural objects that are sacred. And I'm like, you know, dummy, that's art. So within the Black tradition, I mean, nowadays we're seeing more people and more scholars who are picking up on this, particularly because of the African sources. But I mean, I talk about the hoodoo artifacts. I have to use that word.
And let's talk about the hoodoo artifacts, because that actually was one of my questions, because I was really struck in your book where you were talking about how these objects were containers for power, and that there were rituals to bring the power into them, and that often they used graveyard dirt and bones. And I think to our audience, that will be very interesting. And I would just love to hear you talk a little bit about that.
When we talk about African religion, the first thing we think of are the artifacts, the sculptures. So what happens, of course, as Africans are brought as enslaved people to the United States, they're still bringing their spiritual sensibilities with them. They're still bringing their religions with them, and their religions are embodied. I learned a lot more about when I was in graduate school that they weren't just all, you know, there's a term that the anthropologists like to use. They say they are primitive animistic religions. Not so much in the insulting way. It's just they don't have a category. But now we know that Africans are coming to the colonies. They're Christians. The Catholic Church was in West Africa, in Southwest Africa, in the 1500s, man. So these people are already Christians. Of course, many of them are Muslims. Many of them are indigenous. So the African people that come here already have religion. So what is it like when they land? The remnants of all of that mixture, or what became a mixture, come to us in these traditions of hoodoo and conjure. And hoodoo and conjure, I like to use the word magic, but it is a spiritual and material practice. The word I use in the book a lot is healing and harming. I'm not willing to say it's a religion, although some of my friends say it is a religion, but I say it's an ancestral tradition of healing, harming, creating material objects that can do things. This is classic magic. So some of the things that they created were either these containers, they have different names for them. Most people would say, well, that's a voodoo doll. Well, the voodoo doll, by the way, comes from England. It's something that's imposed. It's the English poppet, the poppet dolls. That was imposed on what these folks are doing. So it's not identical. I think people tried to use analogies in order to understand what was going on. But in hoodoo, the artifact that is the hoodoo bag or the conjure bag, and you saw a glimpse of that in Sinners. And the conjure bag is something we know about. It must have started early on, but basically it's just a container for your magical intent. It could have herbs, it could have the dust, it could have both, whatever the intent is. But what's interesting is that these artifact containers, you can do things too. You can make them look a certain way. So even in that, there's sort of a creative, artistic, if I may, element there. So that's where you would find that kind of art. I get itchy using the word art because people go to a certain, you know exactly what I mean.
I do. And it's complicated because I feel like that's part of the problem with African religious objects. And just like I felt like in India, this isn't art. When we think of art, we think of a non-functional object made to delight the eye or raise the soul or something. But I feel like these are objects that were the beauty and the power of the visuals is in service of a function. So the word art doesn't quite describe. I mean, certainly you could talk about aesthetics and material culture because that's all there, but art is so empty compared to what these objects are, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's what happens to Picasso, right? When he goes to the Trocadero and he sees all these masks, he's like, oh, they're art, but they're alive. They're doing something.
Well, you feel that aliveness, right?
That issue of function, though, I want to talk about that because
please. That's
where the religion folk get nervous, because when we're talking about religion as having some sort of function other than saving your soul or whatever, people think, and they told me, oh, you're taking God away. And I'm like, well, I can convince you that it's not doing that. But it's this sense that the functionalist aspect of magics is the dividing line between that and religion. And so when you mention function, I'm like, yes. So if there's a mojo bag, if there's a hoodoo object, what is its function? And I picked up on this long after I wrote the book, and I'm so glad I did, because I probably wouldn't have landed the gig at Center. The function is, again, not so much to bring the god down or the deity, but it is to remember the ancestor. Mm. And that's a very crude way of putting something that's very complex. But if you think about it, every object, every ritual, every magical working in hoodoo conjure is an evocation of the ancestor or the ancestral. We'll just say the ancestral so that people don't say, oh, you're bringing the dead back. Well, yeah, but in a sneaky way. And we don't say it like that, you know, because that's the thing. The dead are alive, and that's the thing that is making it alive. Not so much the deity or the god.
That's super interesting. So it's embodied by not the god. You're not inviting the god, the deity. You're inviting the ancestors into the material culture. And so interesting.
I didn't pick up on that until a few years ago. And after all the research I did, and then I realized, because I don't practice hoodoo. And that's another thing. Most people think I do. Please don't write me and ask for spells or whatever you think I do. I'm not a practitioner in that sense, but I surely venerate my ancestors. I didn't make the connection until I was actually sitting there with my ancestor. I'm like, oh, the charge, the thing that gives hoodoo and conjure its charge. Yeah, God is there. Because people ask me, is Jesus there? Yeah. They use the Bible, whatever. But the charge is in remembering those who came before, whether they're enslaved, whether it's great-great-granny who was working the roots. And I get so many people that call me about this. They're like, well, I think this is in my family in the past. I'm like, okay, ancestor. So that is, I don't know where that comes from. My friends say, well, yeah, that's the African orientation making its way. I'm like, yeah, but you know, in America, Mormons got ancestors. Their whole religion is built. So it might, and I'm not saying it's not African. It might be something that's African-American, because ancestors were so important because that middle passage broke the connection. But I argue back and forth, and because I'm an expert, I can say anything. But on some level, it's not important, but it was such a huge insight.
Well, I think it's fascinating to think about. And it's also fascinating to think about because there's something inherently subversive with slaves keeping the ancestors alive, right? There's a way of keeping something alive that you're not supposed to be, or that the powers that be don't want you to be keeping alive, because it's also bringing power by reminding you of another way life could be and once was.
That is the way you put that is so, I wish you could record it and say it again. Okay. Because that we don't get that. And we don't, I mean, and again, I'm looking at Haiti right now. And Vodou, the religion, is built around the remembrance of those Africans. So what is it to say that Black Americans are doing the same thing, but it's nearly impossible because of that gap of the middle passage? So to me, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
And luckily, scholars are beginning to turn to this and say, ooh, can we talk about ancestors and the dead without getting slapped down and saying that that's, necromancy or whatever the category is for thinking about the dead.
That's got to change, because I feel it could be metaphorical too, right? You don't have to be literal about it. But I feel like all cultures, at least most cultures, have some sort of devotion to the ancestors. If you look at the Catholic cult of the saints, right? I feel like that is a sanctified ancestral tradition. It's right there.
They'll say it, but they won't use certain words.
It's like the magic religion divide, right? And
Absolutely. So Black Americans, I've noticed, particularly the religious folk, and I know because my family, one side is fundamentalists, they begin to sweat. You even bring this up and they're like, oh, and I wonder about that. I'm like, yes, everyone all over the world, it's not ancestor worship. That would actually be very insulting. But somehow that label stuck when the missionaries went to Africa. They said, oh, And so this has been my kind of work of late, to talk about how we think about the ancestral. It ties in a little bit with the morbid, right? Because we are talking about dead people.
Absolutely. Which are, absolutely. And then that makes great. Me think, we went to Lilydale recently, which is a spiritualist. You know about Lilydale. And I was in this room where my friend was giving a talk, and it was filled with images of spiritualists who'd lived before and little captions saying who they were, when they had lived, what they had done. And I was like, this is ancestor veneration. And then suddenly I thought, well, it is literally staying in touch with the ancestors. But then I began to wonder, and I wonder how you feel about this. Is there a difference between a ghost and an ancestor? Is the reason we're afraid of ghosts because we have no ancestral tradition, again, to create a container for it that normalizes it in some way? I don't know.
No, I think you're absolutely right. So the African traditions, and I'll just say the West African traditions answered that question. They have various categories of deadness. So an ancestor can only become an ancestor, and this is important, if you venerate them and remember them. So if you sit with your grandmother and remember her.
I love this. I didn't know that.
They have this notion of shades. They have this notion of ghosts. They have this notion, different levels of revenants. I mean, and some of them have the bodies of animals. I mean, it's spectacular. Right? Native American people too. The dead are not just sleeping in the graves waiting for Jesus. Some of them are. Okay, some of them are. But there's different levels of this. In Black America, there's not a rich distinction except that the ancestor is that who is remembered. The ghost is sort of drifting, homeless. In Haitian Vodou, there's actually a whole category of loa called gere. They're like the homeless dead. But see, this challenges the notion of what's dead and what's alive. Is the ghost dead or alive? Well, it was someone who passed away in the body, but their energy or their spirit is still there. So deadness? is so layered and rich. And to me, that's where we should be spending time instead of being nervous and afraid about it. Now, I know, and you know, death is loaded and charged, but in some ways, it's delightful. It's remembering, making that beautiful artistic altar and remembering Uncle liked his rum and his cigar and setting it up just right. To me, there's also an aesthetic of beauty as well as terror. Both of them have their place when we talk about death. But for Black Americans, I really want us to talk more about the levels and the layers of death. But we're kind of limited because sometimes I find that people are afraid. Frankly, they're afraid to talk about a lot of the stuff. We're weirdos. We're like, more, please.
We're allowed
more.
To talk about it. We're more. Marginalized.
Yeah.
It's true. My brain is exploding from the things you're saying, and I really want to go deeper into this. I'd never thought about the different manifestations the dead can take being affected by the living in the way that you're talking about. And I think that's really profound. I'm really buzzing with that idea.
Oh, good.
In the book, you talk about fear. I think part of the fear that some sorts of Christians have when you start talking about this is somehow in opposition to Christianity, where what you talk about in the book is how Conjure and Christianity were utilized in complementary ways rather than contradictory. And I think that's a really interesting way of thinking.
My point in the book was, in slavery, under slavery, the human being, the enslaved human being, had very few options, all right, in terms of having a life of agency, right? So hoodoo's there, Christianity's there. You can do both. You can do one. You can abide by the rules. But enslaved people, by and large, I believe, were very pragmatic. So hoodoo says it's amoral. You can do this thing to this master who's kicking your butt. You can harm him. And I talk about harming. Or the Christian thing to do is what? Turn the, whatever they used to teach Christians, which many enslaved people were very suspicious, but they went with it. You can use this magic to protect yourself, to defend yourself, and even to harm. Right? That was under slavery. So now we're free. And I say this all the time, and my students do not like it. I was like, you have choices that your ancestors, your great did not have. So are you going to do the right thing or the wrong thing? You're going to do the good thing or the bad thing? And then we get into these great conversations about what that means. So is doing harm, which is completely acceptable in this hoodoo tradition, because it's amoral. It doesn't really care. It's magic, right?
Is magic inherently amoral? It is, isn't it?
It's fire.
Yeah.
You can burn, I can burn you, or I could, you know, make a dinner. So yes. And people have to understand that. It's not like there's an evil devil sitting magic hoodoo devil. So does that carry, because this is a slave tradition,
yeah,
don't forget.
Right.
Does it carry into the present? And so I get into all these conversations about, yeah, we're resisting. We should be able to do this to other people. And I'm like, I cannot tell you. Because a lot of people somehow think that I'm like the hoodoo master. I can tell you about the 19th century. And so it really moves me. Well, first of all, young people care about this. And they want to do, they want to be agents. So what we're seeing now, of course, is how this carries into the present day. These younger people are picking up on it. And with the sinners thing that Ryan Coogler, people are really aware of this.
I would love to talk more about Sinners. I think a lot of our listeners have seen it. It's a great film. And I would love to hear if you could talk a little bit about what your participation was like on that film and how it came about.
I mean, I knew this, but movies take a long time. I worked on this years before it actually came out, even though it was on a rush schedule. So people were calling me about things that happened. I was like, oh, dude. So the producer, Sev Ohanian, called me and said, oh, I saw you on the internet. And I was like, oh, boy, why are you calling my house? Because people do call my house.
Really?
And he said, we have this project and I'm working with Ryan Coogler. And I said to my daughter, Nippy, who's Ryan Coogler? And she said, Mom, come on, Black Panther. And I was like, okay. She was like, are you stupid? So anyways, he said, we have a project. We like your consulting expertise. So I was like, okay, what is it? Sometimes these are very flaky coming out of Hollywood. And he said, Ryan Coogler. I said, all right, well, I need to know more. I'll meet with him. So I met with him. And first off, he's a lovely person. He's a lot like my students, you know, just that bubbling, that beautiful person. And his wife was there too. And he said that he wrote the story himself, which I was like, oh, he's a writer? Ooh, I didn't know who he was. And he's a writer. And he began to tell me. And right off, I said, yeah, this sounds scary. He said, it's got vampires. I was like, I don't do horror. And I said that. And then he said, oh, Professor, you're going to like this story. And I was like, okay, say more. And so he told me the story before he had filmed it. And when he got to the scene and he got so excited, trying to describe that center point scene, but he was so excited. I was like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about.
Which scene do you mean? Do you mean the dance
the
scene?
The center scene where the dancing occurs. He hadn't filmed it. He's sort of mocking it up and he's excited. And then I saw it and it hit me. I was like, oh, are you saying the ancestors come into the present day? I was like, it's effacing time. It's the present. It's the past because they're already dead. And it's the future as well. You're trying to make that scene. And he had the smile. He said, yes, will you? And he got all excited. And I was like, oh, yeah, I would forget the vampire. I would love to talk about that. So that's what started it. But because they were on this crazy schedule, it was crazy. They said, okay, well, fly down to New Orleans. Now I'm in the middle of the semester. Fly down. And then we got to do this. And I was like, no, I can't do that. The actress, Wumi Musako, was playing the Conjure Woman. They wanted me to work with her on embodying her. And that was really delightful because, again, these young people, Ryan and Wumi, they're like my students. They're thoughtful. And so I worked with her for a couple of months on bringing that character to life. And it was wonderful. And I think she mentioned this in one of her interviews. She is of Yoruba descent. So I was like, ooh, let's talk. But like many African-Americans, really estranged from the culture. And then, as expected, her family's Nigerian, very, very hardcore Christians. So she was asking me things. I was like, oh, yeah. We had a pleasant relationship. I think she was having a baby. We did more on their dime talking about life stuff. So I was fortunate. I don't think a lot of jobs are like this. She did a wonderful job bringing that character to life. He did a wonderful job writing the character. And the vampire stuff, you know, I covered my eyes.
I did the same. But I just tried to look at the vampires as like a metaphor for white America. And then I was like, okay, I kind of get why they need to be there. Well, how did you feel about the final film?
I was really nervous. But I was not prepared for the response. People started calling me immediately because my name went up there.
Yes, it was.
My friend texted. She said, I just saw your name.
I texted like, you. I think I took a picture of it and sent it to you too. It might have been me. I was like, oh, there she is.
Oh, my gosh. And I was like, oh. And then they started calling me. So yes, I'm happy with the result. But I'll tell you, my Christian family is not going to see this. Even I asked them, I said, please, my name's in it. And they're like, no, we're not going to see it. Wow. A lot of people that I know will not see
it. Isn't
that
interesting?
Yeah. So I was a little disappointed. I was like, but then I said, okay, it's your loss because I think it's a phenomenon. But yeah, I was happy with it. I was surprised at the success. I really was surprised. But I do hear that there's a turn in horror in popular culture right now. It's a generational thing, I think. But horror is having a turn. So I was pleased that the film could be placed there. And it was a good experience for me.
It's interesting we're talking about horror because that's something I've been thinking about lately, too. I think it's interesting to think again about like marginalized genres that allow people to tell different kinds of stories. I'm not a horror fan anymore either, but the way Coogler was able to big budget create this alternate world, this incredible picture of 1930s South from a African-American perspective. If it took a genre film to allow him to do that, that's amazing. And I wonder if that's partially why those things live there. There's less scrutiny. You could be more wild, maybe a little bit, than with a more traditional or a more sanctified form, like a rom-com or something. Something I've been thinking a lot about, and going back to what we were saying about fear and curiosity and wonder about this phenomenon. And I keep wondering, like, why horror? Why is everything so horrific when we're encountering other, right? You know what I mean? There's this sense of encountering something outside of ourselves and different and other that it seems like the general response is then it's terror. But there are so many other ways that we can deal with things that are different. What does it say about our culture that we want to see it as horror?
Yeah, well, I think that the terror is the psychic filter. But as you recall, right, the valence of the sacred is terror, right? It's what, remember he said the sacred and the profane was? He wrote about encountering the sacred as the terrifying moment, but also there's like this cusp there of just the power of the thing, which is beyond terror and everything else. So I think that has to do with how the sacred is experienced, maybe encountered, but the psychic filter definitely in our culture is terror. It's like, that's the default. But of course, on the other side, we have young hippies like me who are into the bliss of it all, man. Yeah. And so I'd like that to come back around because it hasn't always been terror. Now, I am concerned about the commodification of horror. I don't know too much about it. But again, if this is how people express and maybe clear some of the fear, I don't know if they're clearing or they're getting stuck into it. I think this has to do with the encounter with the sacred, which is the mysterium tremendum, remember?
Yeah.
It's like the thing that is, oh, you know, and yet it's also the beauty. I was thinking about this before I came over here to talk to you about the aesthetics of these things and how even my work on voodoo, often we associate voodoo with horror. What if there's an aesthetic of voodoo that is actually the beauty of it, the pageantry? That's my experience.
That's my experience too, Yvonne. When I look at those photos, I'm so moved by the way the temples are decorated, the art, the flags, the...
Everything, yes.
I agree. Yes. That's what I feel too when I look at those images. I don't feel fear. I feel attraction and curiosity, you know?
That, to me, that's normal. So the question I'm working on with this comic thing is, how do we get from that, the power of the beauty of it, to the horror? And of course, the answer has everything to do with that little incident that happened in 1804 when this Black Republic of Haiti came into being. It was bloody, it was terrible, but it was one of the most beautiful things that ever happened in the Western Hemisphere. Universal emancipation of the enslaved. No nation had ever accomplished it, and they didn't. And so how did that become
so interesting.
Ooh, zombies. Yeah. I'm laughing because everyone thinks I'm writing about the stupid zombies. I'm not. You know, but I have to now. I'm on my last chapter. I have to write about the zombies.
Speaking about the zombies, you're kind of alluding to your new book, and I wanted to ask you what you're working on now. And I think this leads perfectly into it. Can you tell us a little bit about the project you're working on?
Yes. I got into comic books thanks to Jeff Kripal. Not really thanks to him, but Jeffrey Kripal wrote an amazing book on comics called Mutants and Mystics that was based in part on his experience, his spiritual experiences when he went to India and trying to, you know, this theme that humans are part of this story of evolution. So he found threads of that story in comics of the Golden Age. I found threads of a different story in comics of the Golden Age. So I'm focusing, and Golden Age is the 1939 period to the early 50s. This was when Superman, when the comics industry really took off. So of course I'm like, ooh, I want to find out about human evolution. And one of the first comics I pick up has voodoo in it. And I'm like,
randomly?
They're doing, yes.
Wow.
In 1939. And I'm like, oh, this, I got to write about this. So that was, Joanna, that was 8 years ago.
Wow. Wow.
And I said, I have to write about this. So I'm finally writing about it. So the book is, first of all, representations of voodoo, not voodoo. Voodoo is the religion of Haiti. Voodoo is what Adam McGee calls an imagined construct that is based on this fear. So it's completely made up. It's like a made up religion. And so it works its way into
fascinating.
I think so, but no one else gets it.
No,
I think they're writing about zombies.
Well, they won't when they read your book because it's a very nuanced idea, but it's fascinating and very relevant, I think.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that.
I'm excited.
It's been, like I said, it's been 8 years because of what I wanted to do was collect all of the comics that I could find. And at first I said, oh, let me go down to the end of the century where all my friends are looking at the Ungan or the Invisibles and Grant Morrison and Voodoo. And I was like, holy cow, man, I cannot do from the 1930s to So basically looking at that transformation of Voodoo into Voodoo in the comics. I'm getting sick of it, Joanna.
I'm 8 years is a long time. You'll have to celebrate when you're done.
Oh, we will. You're writing a book too, right?
I am. I got an extension though, because I realized the more I read, the more I'm like, there's so much I don't know. That the more I read, the more I'm like, I need to read this. I need to go to Brazil.
That's me. 8 years later, Joanna.
Oh, don't let my editor hear that. So if people want to know more about you and your work, where can they go to find out about you?
AcademicHoodoo.com.
Oh, that's a great name.
You'll find my early work. You'll find my work on Haitian voodoo. You'll find just thoughts and what I have to say about hoodoo and conjure. So that's where most people find me.
Okay. And then I'd like to ask all of our guests three questions to end. So first, looking back over the course of your career, how do you think the idea of death has animated your life and work, if at all?
The idea of death. Oh, that's so personal, right?
What if?
It didn't happen until recently. So I can say, looking back over my life, the idea of death was absolutely terrifying. And it was the gift. Boy, I'm going to cry. It was the gift of my father's passing that changed my life. He was dying of cancer. He knew he was dying. So we had some time. I got to know him in a few months. And at the moment of his passing, I was upstairs and he called me down. I was there. So not only did it help the terror, like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen, but he called me to witness. And that was 15 years ago. Other than that, which was a very personal experience, I was going to say dealing with the dead. Death itself has just always been woven into the research. And now, as I'm looking toward this ancestral question, it's more at the center.
That makes a whole lot of sense. And on that note, has the work that you've done changed your thoughts about death and what may or may not happen after?
Oh, yeah. But that, again, it's more personal. I have a practice. I have a spiritual practice. I actually went to Lilydale.
It's amazing, right?
Oh, it was fun. So I consort with the dead in innumerable ways, whether it's through the spiritualist seance, whether it's through sitting with my own ancestors, whether it's through psychics. I just love that. I love the idea that the veil between these worlds, it's not even a veil now. It's like the dead walk amongst us. And that's certainly part of the tradition. So I feel a lot better about it. As far as I'm concerned, as far as me and death, my mother taught me that you could, I mean, she literally said, I want to have a birthday party at Duke Gardens and have the high tea. And then I'm getting out of here. Mm. And that night she went to the hospital and she was gone. And I was like, oh, mommy, you can speak it. I mean, I'm being glib, but that's really what happened. And it makes me wonder whether we have a saying. Yes, she was incredible. I want to squeeze in as much as I can. I have no fears about this natural thing that happens. But like a lot of people, I love to talk about it. I love to know more. And if in any small way I can help to alleviate that fear, whether it's from my experience or my studies, I'm down for that.
I so second that. It is a wonderful, it's wonderful. So many people are so afraid. And it's wonderful to at least be one voice that talks in a different way about it, right? To give people access to a different way of, a different perspective.
The different perspective. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
My final question is, if you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
Oh, these, who came up with these?
I did.
I'm a little bit of an esotericist. I believe that we do live forever. There is a higher self that is eternal. That's taught in many different religious traditions. You don't have to be a theosophist for that. So knowing that I already do, I would say if I really, really believed that I could live forever, what would it? What was the second part? How would it?
If someone offered you the choice of living forever, would you? I guess in the body, let's say.
In the body. Oh, no. Remember Alan Watts talked about that? He said that we're basically in dreams and we wake up after a little while and then we go back and we just have these adventures. I think I've had all the adventures in the body, right? So I wouldn't, and at least not in this body. I don't want to come back as a mosquito, but as far as embodiment, immortality, I think I'll pass. It's likely that in another form and place, I've done that already. So, you know. That's the good question. That's a cocktail party
question. That's my favorite question of the. I love hearing what people say to that. And it's often unexpected. It's been a really interesting question. It is a great getting to know someone question.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Wonderful. Well, Yvonne, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so fun talking to you as always. Congratulations on your work and good luck with your new book.
You have given me such food for thought. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye. All right. After each episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to get together and talk about the interview. So as always, I'm going to turn it over to Jess first. How did you feel about the talk?
I feel very energized from it. There was so much that I learned in such a short amount of time. I've written pages of notes because I was so fascinated about little tangents I'm going to go off and research and find out about. But one of the concepts that Yvonne shared with us is that deadness is so rich and so layered. And I just thought the way that she described the levels of death and connection to ancestry, I mean, did that stick out for you?
Absolutely. I read her book and I didn't, the ancestor thing is there, but it's, as she said, she kind of stumbled upon that later. So it's not really articulated. And yeah, I mean, I basically was thinking, oh my God, I think she needs to do a whole class on this because I think it's just such a different lens at looking at something that we're familiar with, and it's so rich and so fascinating and so provocative and suggestive.
And you're right when you say that different lens, because that was a similar theme when you guys were talking about why is the instinct now with the supernatural to go to horror or terror? Why is it not delight in remembering, and how that all links back historically to the emancipation of Haiti and how...
Isn't that interesting? I know. I could have listened to her talk a lot more about that. And I think her new book about the comics, that's really what she'll be talking about a lot. And this idea that voodoo is a construct of white fear, essentially. It doesn't exist. It's not a religion that exists in the African-American world. It's super interesting.
And then again, how that has now been reflected back onto African-American religious thoughts and Christianity, and the way that Yvonne was saying magic is not a scary word.
No.
Yet her own family feel like, I don't want to go and watch that movie, Sinners, because of some of the occult themes that it explores and things like that.
Yeah, or the horror aspect was the sense I got too, the fear and the, and I also, I loved horror films when I was young, and now I really can't watch them. And I wasn't interested in Sinners until I started hearing so many people say I had to see it. And it really was all about that dance scene. That dance scene was, knocked my socks off. It was just incredible. I didn't really care about the vampire stuff, though there were parts about it that were interesting. I was thinking about how maybe there aren't story forms that aren't genre story forms, like science fiction, fantasy, like this discredited story forms, essentially lowbrow story forms that allow us to tell these kinds of stories. One of our former guests was Tiffany Hopkins. And I remember she was talking about there's no traditional narrative form that she can use to talk about her experience, because we're so concerned with true versus false, you know? And when she's talking about her experience, she can only use fantasy or sci-fi or some other story form that allows, that doesn't have so many barriers in how we're thinking about things. And I think fairy tales are another one. I just finished a book on fairy tales. That's another story form that allows us to get outside the constructs of what's real and what's not, allows us to play with what, with other ideas of reality. And I think horror films allow that. But maybe there needs to be a new form that isn't based in fear, but that also allows us to explore that. I would love to see that emerge.
Yeah, a way to explore the other without it having to link directly to terror or
exactly.
Horror.
I've been thinking a lot about the Judeo-Christian idea of good and evil, and this idea of duality, that where one has to dominate the other, or one is good and one is bad. And there's so many other ways of looking at opposites, you know, like yin and yang being a great example, in which they're complementary, in which their interaction creates the dynamism of our lived experience. And I think I would love to see some of those concepts trickling into storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe Paul Giamatti will do it for us after.
Yeah, let's hope so.
And just finally, there was lots of reference to Jeffrey Krepal in there as well. So I would urge people that are interested in some of the things that Yvonne was talking about, linked to that, to listen back to the Jeffrey Krepal episode, and also touched on Lilydale in a few ways. And I know that in our Tiffany episode, and in our Asti episode, and in our Shannon episode, we touch on Lilydale quite a lot in those as well, so it's worth going back.
Absolutely. And I know, I should say, I know Yvonne because of Jeff Krepal. Because, is that true? No, I think I know her because of my friend Amy, who did a dissertation that she was involved with. But then I met her for the first time at Jeff Krepal's conference. So it's a very small world of religious studies, very interesting religious studies people.
Yeah. Actually, I hadn't heard the term religionist.
I hadn't heard that either. I love that.
Oh, hadn't you? Okay. No. I thought that was a me thing.
Yeah. I want to be a religionist. I know. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I know. It's a cool title. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com.
Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.